I'd like to call Senate Resources to order, March 22nd. I want the record to note that President Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator Seekins, Senator Elton, and Senators Kukesh, and myself, Senator Wagner. Senator Dyson is tied up at the, on the other side of the building testifying. He will join us as soon as possible. Today, we're going to take up amendments that were passed out. They're, it's not yours, Senator.
Where is mine?
Should have been, should be right.
Okay.
Behind this.
Got it. Thanks.
We'll take up technical number one, technical number two, administrative number one. And then we'll take up substantive memo, or amendment number one, dealing with the 5,000 barrel item. And if there's time left, we'll take up number two, and that's the new clawback provision. That's probably as far as we'll get today. I plan to recess today and call the chair. We'll go back at 10 a.m. tomorrow in this room. So I want to check and make sure everybody's got the amendments.
That's provided that the Senate Judiciary Committee cancels its meeting in this room tomorrow morning.
10 a.m.
You're kidding me.
All right. That's the humor of the day.
I hope that's all we have to left.
Everybody got technical amendment number one?
Yep.
Number two and administrative amendment number one. Okay. That also, when we get to on in the program and start considering the amendment on the 5,000 barrel credits and on the new clawback provision, Robert Mintz will be online for any questions we might have dealing with those two amendments. With that, I'll turn the meeting over to Ms. Jackson, or I'll call Ms. Jackson to the chair, and we'll turn the meeting over to her. And you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Senator Tom Wagoner and staff to the Senate Resource Committee. Mr. Chairman, as a preface, I just remind everyone that on Monday we handed out information that went through the entire bill. And when I took it from the first page of the bill and identified it as number one, number two, number three, going in page order, my thought was to provide kind of a roadmap so it would be simple reference back. Some of those items were administrative issues that were raised. Some of them were technical issues that we had raised earlier. And some of them, of course, were substantive issues. So we have that roadmap that's in back of all of these. And then when I got these in, I tried to provide yet again information to each one of you so that you would be able to reference each section of the amendment back to that roadmap. And I hope it was helpful. It certainly wasn't intended to be confusing, but I hope it helped. And with that, Senator Wagner, on technical amendment number one, I note there were three at the bottom of the cover sheet on it. It says note page two. When we get there, you'll see that it's supposed to be inserted after the second is. There are two is's in that sentence, and we wanted to make sure that was clear. On page two, also, it reads transferers, and it should read transferees. I have hand marked that out. On page three, and again, when we get there, I'll go over it again, but I wanted to make sure everyone had that. We're still trying to verify whether or not, or we were when we printed this, whether or not this item was necessary. And I've just been pointed out to me, and if you would follow along with me, on page 2, line 22, it says page 12, line 21. That should read page 12, line 22.
Go through that one more time.
Yes, sir. On page 2, mm-hmm. line 20, it should read page 12, line 22.
Okay.
It was an incorrect line reference. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll just go forward to page one of the amendment. And I point out to you that lines 1 through 12 all pertain to our topic, our roadmap, number 4. Number 4 was the deletion of the language on royalty, tax on royalty, and it also authorized the commissioner to establish a tax. The commissioner did not want that responsibility and pointed out that this was a legislative function. Senator Wagner said to delete it. So we have that deleted. The amendments that you see on lines 1 and 2 are technical, so that we have a continuation. Line 4 is, and 5 are to delete the reference to that subsection that you're deleting. And then all the way down through, those are technical things to clean that subsection up. Still on page 1, on line 14, this is item number 6. Mr. Chairman, this is regarding the safe harbor provision that was in the original bill. The original bill was a 90%. At your direction, this language was revised to read 95% with a true-up on a quarterly basis. On page 2...
Just a minute.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, if I may, we went over 2 times today with administration to make sure that this language was language that they, too, were comfortable with. There are a couple of pieces in here that they don't feel comfortable with, and I will identify those as we get to them.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Continuing on page 2, line 1. This is item number 7. There was a phrase about oil sold, oil and gas sold, and oil and gas not sold. We put produced in front of the one section, but we did not follow it through in the second section. So this amendment simply clarifies that. The net result would be that it would read produced and it fits within both of them. I point out this is the insertion at the second is in that line. And let me, I'm sorry, I should have had this open to it. On page 8, line 21 in the Y version of the bill is where this comes in. The net result of this is it would read then, if oil or gas is produced but not sold, or if oil or gas is produced and sold.
Do that. Read through that one more time.
Yes, sir. On page 8, line 21 of the Y version, the new language would be, if oil or gas is produced but not sold, comma, or if oil or gas is produced and sold. So the insertion goes after the second is. Continuing on page 2, number 9. Number 9, this was an error on my part. I picked up language that had been requested by Oyaoga, and who were probably very happy with it, but this was a technical amendment, and this is also, Mr. Chairman, on page 2, line 13. Please note that this is where, rather than transferers, it should read transferees. Mr. Chairman, this also corrects technical error number 10. Number 10 was improper insertion of the House language into the Senate bill, that this now removes it all. And these subsections need to be renumbered accordingly. Continuing on page 2, line 20, I note again that the first line is line 21 should read line 22. This is issue number 13 and also issue number 22. The concern that was expressed by the administration was that the term similar regulatory made this overly broad. And in order to ratchet that down, we have inserted economically in one area, which they agreed with, and then in the second set here on on line 26, we have deleted similar and inserted any successor. And if you recall, this was raised by Ms. Wilson, that it was very vague, and they weren't sure whether this meant a similar regulatory body. Did that mean DEC, or did that specifically mean, for example, a successor body to the RCA? So this has been clarified that it is intended to be a successor to the RCA, or excuse me, a successor body. Moving on then to page 3, line 1.
When you're jumping back and forth, when you say page 3.
I'm sorry, reference
the
page.
Please reference the amendments.
Yeah. You can't see what page I'm looking at from there. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm on technical amendment number 1, page 3. The top of the page, line 1, is item number 14 on the roadmap. The chairman recommended that this be deleted. This had been raised as a topic of concern, so lines 25 through 29 will be deleted. Those show on page 12 of the bill, lines 25 through 29. Read now, subsection B, an asset in which the state directly or indirectly holds an ownership interest equal to or greater than 5% for the purpose of making a determination of ownership interest under this subparagraph, the state's ownership of an interest in the land on which the asset is located shall be excluded. So that language will now be deleted. Continuing with the technical amendment number 1, on lines 5 and 6, those are drafting insertions to correct the deletions that occurred previously. So I is now H. Continuing on with the technical amendment on page 3, line 8, this is number 6, and Mr. Chairman, this is the issue that we showed at the front as a question from the administration on whether or not we still needed it. So I'm going to ask that this be deleted from this amendment right now, and we will go back over that. They were looking at that. Or are we okay with it now? You want it deleted, right? Okay. You're okay with it? Oh. Trying to help them. I beg your pardon. Mr. Chairman, administration is fine with this now. When we worked over this morning, they wanted to double check it. We're fine with it. So this is item number 6 on your roadmap.
Senator Seekins.
I have a question on this, and maybe it's just how I'm reading it. But addition to other required, the official file statement on or before the first day of each calendar quarter of a year, showing any adjustments or corrections to the statements that were required under A of this section to be filed for the 3 months of the preceding calendar year during which the oil or gas was produced. reduced each of the 3 months period. So, in reality, what does this say he has to do?
You want to have Mr. Dickinson come up?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sequins, my name is Dan Dickinson. I'm a CPA currently working with the governor's office on the PPT legislation. Senator Sequins, if you might, if you go back several pages earlier, there was a requirement that there be a quarterly true-up. What this language is there for is if for some reason at the end of the quarter you don't have an actual tax obligation, but you're doing the true-up, then you still have the requirement to file and do your true-up. And so it's a little bit in the section that says you have every time you pay you have to file, and this deals with a situation in which you have an obligation to file but you don't have to pay, and that's why we have to call it out specifically. So what this to be very specific is what this will require is a filing at the end of every calendar quarter for everyone who normally has production. This will pose no additional obligation.
But what I'm looking at is, Mr. Chairman, if I can, particularly on line 13, where it says this section should be filed for the 3 months of the preceding calendar year during which the oil or gas was produced. Is this requiring a monthly or a quarterly true up? But it's not referring back to the previous quarter. It's referring back to the previous calendar year, and I'm not sure that's the language you want in there.
Senator Sequins, I apologize. You've caught a glitch. I probably read that four times, and I saw what I was reading, not what I read. So I appreciate that. We can maybe if I take a second and change those words around a little bit, and we can come back to it, or do you want to just
or strike it and.
Well, I think you just meant for the previous quarter.
I think that's correct. Probably for the preceding calendar quarter.
Yes, rather than year.
Yes.
It's a simple correction, but now I can understand it.
3 months before the preceding calendar quarter instead of year.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
This is the function of me being an editor, I guess. Is there any such thing as a calendar quarter? Why isn't it just a preceding quarter?
Well, you've got calendar quarter year. Defined two lines farther down, one line farther down,
calendar.
Mr. Chairman.
You do, yeah. Here.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, 13, 13, year,
okay. 2, quarter. Quarters. Each quarter is fine with me.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to handle that as a friendly amendment? Do you want to move that? All right. Then I'm going to. I've
Mr.
highlighted.
Point of order.
Excuse me, Senator Stevens.
The amendment hasn't actually been offered, so I wouldn't consider it a friendly amendment because the amendment hasn't even been put forward.
Just a correction.
I think we just do an editorial correction and go on with it.
Thank you. And I am, Mr. Chairman, noting all of these on the front of the page, too, and we'll take care of all of it when we go through with Mr. Chenoweth.
When we get through with this, then we'll have a motion on the amendment.
Yes, sir. Then continuing on technical amendment number 3, line 17, this is deletion of the word or. Mr. Chairman, this references roadmap item number 15. There was considerable discussion on this word, and the administration successfully persuaded the chairman to remove that word. Continuing further on page 3 of technical amendment number 1, line 20. This is a drafting correction that was made, and it simply says on the bill, page 16, line 26. Page 16, line 29. It says, a new subsection, and we are deleting that and inserting new subsections. Mr. Chairman, going forward, technical amendment number one on page 3, line 17. This references number 17 on the roadmap. This was regards to the valuation, how they're going to have the valuation. There were a lot of discussion on whether or not royalty settlement agreement should be a basis. Mr. Chairman, I believe administration still has some concerns about this. Administration has concerns about this item. This would be page 3, line 17 through 21.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, I would make the request that this this amendment be removed from the technical amendment category and put in a substantive amendment, because this is a substantive change in the policy that's prescribed in this this section of the law. So I would request that that be set aside and not a technical amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I will note that that'll be substantive number 5.
Okay.
For tomorrow.
That's line 17.
Mr. Chairman, for the committee's edification, that's page 3, lines 24 to 31, and page 4, lines 1 through 4. That will be substantive number 5. Then going forward, Mr. Chairman, on page 4 of technical.
Senator Stevens.
We have on, if we could go back to page 17 of the bill, please. We have two components here that refer to two different subchapters. Where the first component, line 19, deleting A, is one substantive item, and then the other substantive item is a new subsection, a new chapter, 455160, whereas the other one relates to a 150. I don't think that they're exactly under the same the same topic. One has to do with transitional investments, and one has to do with valuation.
Make notation of that, and we'll
yes, sir.
Work through that in the morning.
Thank you.
And that's line 25 on 17 through 4.
On the one side, on the and then page. That's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't hear that, please.
The other section is from line 25 on page 17, from line 25 through line 4 on page 18.
Ms. Jackson. It looks to me, is the one on top of page 4, is that 17 or is that 18?
17. 17? Oops. I got to go back again. Wait a minute. It's number 17 still. I think they're all the same thing, but we'll certainly double check it.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Mary.
Mr. Chairman, continuing on with technical amendment number 1 on page 4, line 6. This is referencing roadmap number 19. The I'm looking at page 19 of the bill, and lines 3 and 4 are where this was, and I'll just read the tail end of it. It reads, or producing and oil or gas from a deposit of oil or gas. So it was either from a or and that need to be removed. The drafter determined that the appropriate thing would be to remove and. The net result is that the line would read then, or producing oil or gas from a deposit of oil or gas. I expect it was just a typographical. Continuing on page 4 of technical number 1, on line 9, this references roadmap number 20. Roadmap number 20 was requested by AOGA, Alaska Oil and Gas Association. This was language change that the administration agreed to. The changes would be to delete this phrase, the operator or a working interest owner, and insert a producer that is an operator. The result of it would be, this is on page 19, lines 16 and 17, so that it would read, the Department of Revenue may authorize a producer that is an operator to treat as its lease expenditures, et cetera, et cetera. Continuing on technical page 4, line 13, page 20 of the bill, line 6, and it is roadmap number 21. This was capital assets. The term capital assets is being deleted. This was at the request of the administration. Continuing on page 4, lines 16 through 23, Mr. Chairman, these all deal with the issue of the board, the regulatory board. And it was just pointed out that we have this one conflicts with the one that's in here earlier. It's not a huge conflict, but nonetheless there's a conflict. So I'm going to request that we have this language reads the same as the language that's shown on page 2, lines 20 through 31. Excuse me, lines 23 through 31. Basically, Mr. Chairman, and we have similar, similar regulatory, and then we have a similar successor.
Okay, run through that one more time.
Yes, sir. I know, it didn't get caught.
No.
This one was, again, this was the request by the department that it be a similar successor body. So on page...
not similar, but a successor body.
Successor body, excuse me. Yes, similar gets deleted and it becomes a successor body. And it reads the same in both sections.
So it would be a successor to either FERC or to RCA.
That's correct, Mr. Senator Seekins, through the chair. Mr. Chairman, that's the end of the technical number 1. With the withdrawal, that will show up tomorrow.
Going back, when we went over this previously and did our roadmap on page 19 of the bill,
okay,
line 29, Were we going to put definitions in there?
Through the, to the chair, pardon me. Yes, sir. The definitions are the ones that were worked on by the administration, and they actually show up in the administrative group.
Okay.
We knew we needed to delete this one. We didn't know what was going to be the definition, so we at least covered this deletion through the technical amendments.
Okay. Any questions on this technical amendment one? You okay with it?
At this point.
You want to adopt, move for adopting it?
I move to adopt amendment number, technical amendment number one, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I object. Point of order.
Mr.
Chairman, I object on a point of order. I don't believe we've adopted the working draft yet.
Oh.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Probably true.
Probably right. So you want to save these until later, or you want to move to adopt the working draft? I'd entertain a motion to adopt the working draft we have in front of us.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we adopt version Yankee of this bill as the working draft for the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to object.
Speak your objection.
Mr. Chairman, I may object because for several reasons, but the main reason is, Mr. Chairman, as we all know, I don't agree with the rates that have been proposed in this committee substitute. And I'll object to the adoption of this working draft based on that and several others, but that will be the main reason why I'm going to object to the adoption of the working draft.
Any other?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Seegans?
I understand the senator's objection. However, there's this. We have to have some kind of a document to work on to amend. Otherwise, the amendments that we're looking at go back to our original bill, which doesn't give me anything to work on or to amend. So, I look at it at the bill as a work in process that's subject to amendment and not the final product of the committee.
Further discussion, Senator Stedman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the point of some of the details in this bill we'll continue to work on and through the amendment process. I'm sure we'll have a substantial amount of debate, but we do need a forum to work from. And we've spent quite a bit of time on this already.
Further questions, Senator?
One final comment, Mr. Chairman. The technical amendments, number one, number two, administrative amendment number one are the result of the working draft. We could adopt the original bill and move to the substantive amendments and get to where we want to go. And with that, I'll close my comment and maintain my objection.
Okay. Further comments?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Seegans.
I think, let me ask you the intent of the chair. In the end, as we amend this working draft, it's going to be a complicated piece of work. I'm imagining that how, as it's amended, will come back to us as a CS for further consideration that will incorporate the amendments that we put into it. Am I correct?
We hope to have that back to you from the drafters on or before 5 o'clock Friday.
And I would, even at that point, take a look at that CS as also a document that once we see how all the amendments come together and flow together would be subject to further amendment. Am I correct in assuming that?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? Can you maintain your objection, Senator Seegans?
Yes.
Please call the roll.
Senator Stedman?
No.
Senator Ben Stevens?
No.
Senator Elton?
Yes.
Senator Kukesh?
Yes.
Senator Seegans?
I'll vote yes.
Chair Wagner?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stedman?
I meant to vote in the positive.
Senator Seegans?
Senator Stedman would like to change his vote from a no to a yes. He's got one knocked off already.
He just wanted to vote against.
He's in close time.
So we've adopted working draft / Y. Chair now entertain a motion to adopt technical amendments 1.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I object for the statement, please. To the amendment, technical amendment number 1.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, the technical amendment number 1 has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 approximately changes. And I respect the work that's gone into the bill on the technical corrections, and I think it's been a lot of work to try to organize it. However, I disagree that some of the sections in here classify as technical. I think some of the deletions that were a part of this technical correction were major substantive policy, and I had anticipated a debate on that substantive policy that was inserted, and as to the definition of why it was inserted, as well as the justification for the insertion. And I wanted to make that statement that I don't believe that the technical corrections are minimal to technical, where some are substantive. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection.
Senator Elton?
Just a point of clarification for me. I mean, we've moved technical amendment number 1, but I'm assuming that motion reflects the decision that was made that we remove on page 3 of the amendment from line 24 to page 4 of the amendment on
right.
Line 4 that yeah. That is removed from.
Senator Seekins?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I may technically agree with Senator Stevens that some of these amendments may have crossed over into the substantive area, but my intent on moving the motion is to come up with a document that I can take a look at that's an integrated document for further consideration.
And if it's necessary to address those, Monday we'll have another go around with committee. So you withdrew your, Senator Stedman?
Oh, I just, that's fine. I just want to make a quick comment. I think that the, a couple of these in particular are substantial policy changes, but you know we got a lot of issues here to cover the next couple of days, and I'd like us to adopt this technical amendment number 1 and then move on.
Senator Stevens has withdrawn his objection, so if there's no objection, then technical amendment number 1 will be adopted.
Next item before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry. Technical number 2 was requested by the administration, and
right.
Mr. Dickinson is here.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dan Dickinson, and just to clarify, I don't know if this happened on everyone's, but at least on mine, the final page is not, in fact, is part of the next, it's part of the administrative amendment. So there's another amendment offered. Well. So the final page was not part of the.
All right, Mr. Chairman. Senator Seeker.
This is not part of it?
Correct.
As a point of.
Throw that other page away, though.
As a point of procedure and of order.
You have singled.
Mr. Chairman, do we need to move the amendment, or are we in a pre-editing mode as we were in the technical amendment number 1?
Let's go through the amendment, and then if we
okay.
Make some minor corrections, we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, what this does is, in the original administration bill, and we had a date of July 1st would have been the effective date, when the bill was being drafted, we believed there was enough time between when the bill was being introduced and the time the first payments would have had to have been made, would have been in the end of August taxpayers to get their technical systems in order. Clearly, if the date is moved back to April 1st, that's 9 days from now, and I don't believe there will be enough time. So what we've done here is we've created a set of transition provisions. I'm not going to go through each one of them, but let me broadly describe the three pieces. The first one simply is we've made sure that, where you have three quarters of a year, it's appropriate to some of the numbers need to get adjusted, so there's three quarters instead of the entire year. Or in the administration's bill, there were 6 months. So we simply made an adjustment for the three quarters. The second set, and that's really lines 1 through 15 on page 1. Starting with page 15, section F here, and again, these are all part of the uncodified law, so these are just transition provisions. What we've said there is for the first 180 days after the bill passes, the first 6 months of payments, taxpayers can pay what they would have owed under the existing statutes. In the seventh month, you have to true everything up, interest, penalties, all that kind of stuff will then apply therefore. So we basically carve out whatever date it is, 6 months, and then the seventh. And then the final point is, and this goes on the page 2, lines 11 through 17, and this basically says that when we're going to be writing regulations to enforce all this, it'll be, you know, in May and June, July, you're granting us authority here to make those retroactive to the effective date of the bill, which is April 1st. So these are all transition provisions designed to make that work with an April 1st effective date.
Questions of Mr. Dickinson?
This gives the companies and the state enough time to set up their accounting procedures accordingly. Won't be putting any hardship on anybody.
Senator Wagner, the 6 months for especially for complex regulations is a compressed time frame, but it's important. The department will have to put a lot of resources on that. I believe 6 months is adequate.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Dickinson? Thank you.
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. During that period of time, thank you. During that period of time, that there is no penalty assessed during that first 6 months period.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, if they underpaid what they owed under the current rules, yes, there could be a penalty or interest. But they have a safe harbor as long as they pay what's owed under current rules. Then there's no penalty.
Thank you for that clarification.
Excuse me. Okay. Is there a motion to adopt technical amendment number 2?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the amendment and object.
Okay. Want to speak to your objection?
My objection is not to the content particularly of the amendment, but in my own code of ethics, a retroactive tax is not fair, and so I will have a hard time voting for any tax that precedes the effective date of a bill.
Further discussion? Senator Stedman?
I don't know what the final bill is going to look like, but I think initially there was a lot of talk about this tax being in place as far as January 1, and now we're looking at, you know, the end of the first quarter and or into April.
Into the third quarter.
So that would, I think, work out fairly well.
Further discussion? Maintain your objection?
No, I'll remove my objection, but I wanted it stated on the record that I may have a further amendment to propose after this amendment may be adopted, Mr. Chairman. And it would be rather substantive.
Well, I thought Mr. Seekins was going to allow me to say my objection in one word. But
I'll allow you to. I'll renew my objection until Mr. Senator Stevens has his opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I mean, we can count. We don't need to go through the process. But I just want the record to show that I'm the same mind as Senator Seekins on that statement. But we can count. So unless it looks like there's somebody's going to swing, but I'll remove my objection.
And mine is removed, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no objection being maintained, then we'll adopt technical amendment number two. Next amendment in front of us, administrative amendment number one. Mr. These have to do, remember the meeting when we went over the bill previously, there was a lot of discussion by Robin Williams about the information in here on taxes and disagreements. And Mr. Balash has been working with the administration with our tax consultant on clearing up some of the disagreements on this. So, Joe, you like to present this, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Balash.
Excuse me. We'll do the same thing as we go through here. If there's some minor corrections, we'll go ahead and make those and then address the amendment later. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Joe Balash, staff to the Budget and Audit Committee. As the chairman indicated, the language in Section 26 that deals with a number of the tax base adjustments, determinations of value, credits, payments, adjustments to those, there were some recommendations identified by tax counsel, Mr. Marvin Kirshner at the firm of Greenberg Traurig. On Saturday, the administration raised a number of issues, questions to the committee. We then on Monday convened a teleconference and spent a considerable amount of time discussing what the areas of concern were for Mr. Kirshner. The department, I think, now has a better understanding of what he was attempting to accomplish in crafting the language. We were able to resolve a number of the issues just to make the legislation flow more efficiently and make it easier on those who have to administer the law. A number of references got mixed up in the drafting process. Those were relatively straightforward to take care of. As far as the item related to management fees, the department understands, helped us craft a revision to that item. The recapture provisions that are used in the earlier section of the bill, new 024, dealing with the qualified capital expenditure, similar provisions weren't in place for the deductions, which is what Section 160 does, and so we were able to address that. Some areas there that deal with asset churning and removal of assets from the state, and then also an item which Mr. Kirshner raised, the department agreed that we need to include in the list on D2. Those items which do not count as direct costs, the acquisition of a business entity, and so there we were able to resolve a large number of issues. There were also some areas that they requested additional language to be inserted. In particular, you see on amendment page one, the first three items and then the sixth item were all suggestions that came from the department and were incorporated into this language. And I would like to note that the department would have drafted this amendment were it not for Deputy AG's or Assistant AG Mintz needing to focus his attention on the additional provisions. So this has been a team effort. We have reached a point now that the technical pieces of the amendment work. The department agrees. I have a note from Mr. Mintz that says so, if anybody would like it.
Anybody want a copy of this for their records?
Yes.
Okay, so would you have that
absolutely
run off and distributed to the entire committee?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I will note that one item which was left unresolved has to do with section or subsection L, which appears on page 23, beginning at line 29 through line 13. We did go to the effort of correcting the references, identifying the penalty, and however, I would note that the department is not certain that they need the additional audit powers granted by this subsection. That seemed to be a substantive issue that was beyond the charge of resolving. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions, if I can.
Senator Stedman.
Here on the second paragraph, on the paragraph, the line numbers, or the page is not numbered, so but it's the second paragraph where it refers to page 18, line 23, insert a new paragraph.
Yes, sir.
In the center of that paragraph, there's the words, is considered
producer?
Producer. You want to explain that paragraph?
This was a request that came in from the department to substitute language, and if I can identify it here, this goes into Part B, and I do think that Deputy, or I'm sorry, Assistant AG.
Let's just take a brief at ease.
That was brief.
Not a trick question.
Mr. Mintz is online, and perhaps he can walk through this. You on there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Can I ask that Mr. Bayless repeat what part we're referring to?
Okay, it's on page one of the amendments, on the administrative amendment.
Okay.
And midway down, it says, is considered a producer?
Yes.
That was your question,
yeah,
Senator Stedman?
Yeah, just have him explain the paragraph. I've got a couple of these I'd like him to
do. Yeah, just like an explanation of that paragraph, if you would, please.
Sure, yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Stedman. Several of these amendments that all probably are equally okay, they're intended to deal with basically a timing mismatch. Now, one of the provisions of the bill is that the main tax credits that are provided, for example, to encourage capital investment in oil and gas exploration, could be used by companies that are doing exploration, even if they don't have any production, and they're even if they don't have production tax. And the way that works is that through the ability of the company to turn a credit into a certificate that then can be sold and monetized immediately. But one of the kind of basic rules in terms of what you can get a credit for is that the lease expenditures should be actual net lease expenditures. And subsection E of new section 160 of the production tax statute provides that when a producer gets certain types of reimbursements or sells assets that were previously acquired, that those reimbursements or payments have to be netted against the expenditures so that you only get to deduct the net expenditures. Well, the problem is, what happens if a deductible expenditure is made in one period, but the reimbursement or payment that is received doesn't occur until a later period? And in the case of, say, a company that's doing exploration but has no production tax, in the later period, you might not be able to recapture that benefit. And what this does is say, or what these several provisions do, is say that even if you don't have any lease expenditures in the period, even if you don't have any oil and gas production in the period, if you get one of these reimbursement or similar payments in during that period, you have to treat that as a negative lease expenditure, and that leads to a positive production tax. And so with this particular provision, the bottom half of page one of the amendment says, if you're an explorer that's not producing oil and gas and therefore would not ordinarily be considered a producer that would owe tax, for purposes of this kind of recapture provision, that the explorer will be considered a producer and it will be subject to the production tax.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. I have another one on the following page.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Before we go, Mr. Senator Stedman, you lost me there at the end, Mr. Mintz, that if an explorer has no production tax liability, what's the purpose of creating that he's creating him as that entity as a production taxpayer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, perhaps I could go through a simple example, and I'd ask Dan Dickinson to kind of keep track of my numbers to make sure I'm not making a mistake. But let's take an explorer that in say 2007 spent $1 million on exploration, and he's allowed to treat that as lease expenditures, and since there's no oil and gas production to generate a positive value, he basically gets a negative $1 million, which is a loss of $1 million. He can convert that into a credit at 20% or 25%, I guess, under the committee substitute. And basically sell it for $250,000. Now, if during that year the explorer had sold the asset that he acquired essentially for $1 million, he sold it for $500,000, he would have been required to net the sale receipts of $500,000 against $1 million and could only take a credit for the net outlay of $500,000. But the hypothetical is, suppose that the sale doesn't take place until 2008. Well, there's no longer a $1 million expense to net the $500,000 revenue against. So basically, the explorer would have got the benefit of the full $1 million expense without having to net it, to net that revenue against it. And so what this says is, in that second year, 2008, you're going to have to treat the $500,000 revenue as a negative lease expenditure, which would create a tax liability. And that's why this provision at the bottom of page one says the explorer is going to be treated as a producer subject to that production tax. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to follow through with the basic principle that only net expenses would be deductible and eligible for credit.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Stedman?
There's proof, Mr. Chairman, that the explanation of the paragraph is substantially longer than the paragraph.
But I think Senator Stevens said he understood it, so he's going to explain it to me again later.
I thought we proved that statement with or.
If we could go to the next one, the next page, and again, the pages aren't numbered, so I apologize for that. But the one that's referred, it's the top of the next page, page 19. It's referencing page 19, line 29.
Yeah, it's the second page, Mr. Mintz.
Yeah.
The deletion is outlay of capital assets. That is going to be deleted, and there's going to be an insertion. And could you please explain that paragraph? One of the issues we have, of course, when we start working with credits is that they're applicable to what we intend them to be, and they're not an abusive item. So if you could give us an explanation on this.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason that originally the bill had the term outlay for capital assets was simply to make clear that expenditures for capital are being treated differently under this new production tax than they generally are. Generally, there's a distinction between operating expenses, which are fully deductible during the time period that they're incurred, and capital expenditures, on the other hand, which because they last for a long time, generally have to be spread out over time through depreciation or amortization. And all that we're trying to do here is say we're not following that general rule in this bill, but instead the full amount of money that you spend in a capital expenditure is deductible in the time period that you make it. Now, I think that the tax consultants for the committee raised some questions about, well, this term capital asset, what does that mean? That could cause all kinds of interpretation problems. For example, could it include the purchase of a company or purchase of stock in a company? We looked at that again in light of those questions. We realized really no need to introduce this new term capital asset, and instead the language that's proposed more directly accomplishes what we're trying to do, which is simply to say that if you spend money on something to acquire something that this should be treated as a direct cost, even if the normal capitalization rules under income tax rules or under financial accounting rules would require that to be spread over time for depreciation or amortization, then in this case you can deduct the expenditure when it's incurred. So we don't have to deal with interpretation issues of what capital assets mean. All we're saying is you don't depreciate, you deduct it at the time it's incurred.
Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Minzer, I think at one earlier point we talked about being able to deduct something as a capital expense is for purposes of PPT. Would that same acquisition or expenditure then, if it's treated as an expense in financial accounting or for federal income tax purposes, be deductible? Be a deductible item on state income tax?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deacons, I should probably ask Dan Dickinson or Robin Wilson to jump in if I'm wrong, but the intent here is not to affect at all how items are handled for income tax purposes.
I was just wondering because I think, Mr. Chairman, if I remember, we were talking about earlier that it wasn't our intent in the bill to be able to create double deductibles, and I just wondered if we were in the area of doing that at this with this particular provision.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is an expenditure that would be treated as a capital expenditure for income tax purposes would continue to be treated that way. And all this is saying that for production tax purposes, it would be deducted in the same way as an operating expense.
Senator Seekins, Mr. Chairman, maybe I don't quite understand the question, but that's correct. We are not affecting how things are done in income tax. And in general, what we're trying to do is build on the rules that apply in income tax, so we've got sort of less work to do, less arguments. If it's capital for the income tax purposes, then it's capital for the PPT.
All right.
But we're borrowing the rules. We're not affecting them.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr.
Senator Stedman?
Well, we're on the subject, just as a broader note, it's, I guess, less technical than the wordsmithing we're doing today. But when a producer in the state of Alaska purchases an office building in Fairbanks or Anchorage and/or a company vehicle for Anchorage, are they going to be able to get a credit as we envision in this bill to take against their PPT tax?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, Dan Dickinson again. Generally, no. Generally, what I would envision happening is that there's a set of direct costs, generally what we're going to do, as it says elsewhere in the bill, as proposed by the administration and as remains in this, we're going to look at the kinds of things that partners agree to pay for when they have joint operating agreements, when they operate a field like Prudhoe Bay where you have many owners. And typically, an office building in Fairbanks would not qualify. What you might see is an overhead rate built in, which recognizes the fact that when you have employees working on the North Slope, you have to house them someplace. So there might be an overhead that would acknowledge that. But generally speaking, sir, no, you would not. Direct costs are going to be direct costs, and then there'll be an allowance for overhead, but the kinds of things like buildings would not be considered direct costs.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I understand you correctly, if they build a bunkhouse in Prudhoe Bay versus a bunkhouse in Fairbanks, neither one of them would be available for the PPT credit?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, in fact, if the unit were to build a bunkhouse, a living facility, and people rotate in and out who are working on that field, I believe that probably could qualify as a direct cost, because it would be a physical structure needed, because you simply, if in a remote area, you can't fly people in and out every day to do their job.
So that in this example, that would exclude then the entity or the unit in Fairbanks and include the one on the slope.
Senator Stedman, through the chair again, I keep trying to say generally on these. I think that's correct. You need workers where you are producing oil, and so typically facilities for them next to the operations, so they can get to and from them, typically, especially if they're on 12-hour shifts, 12 on, 12 off type thing, will be included. Support facilities like you might have in Fairbanks typically will not. I don't want to prejudge any case, but that's at least how I would think about this.
Yeah, one more follow-up.
Senator Stedman.
When there's qualifiers like that and there's a potential chance of interpretation for a migration to Fairbanks and maybe a migration to Anchorage, is there any chance at all that they could migrate to Dallas? And it's a serious question, because
no, Senator, through the chair, I mean, you are absolutely correct, and I, you know, if I'm throwing out a hypothetical here, but let's say there were a group that were assembled, to work on a specific heavy oil problem, and they were located in Dallas, and all the owners agreed they needed a building with a test facility in it. That might be something that, by an industry standard, would look at and say, yes, that's a specifics problem we have to solve. The way we're going to do it is we're going to spend some money here. So again, you know, what this bill allows us to do is to look at the kinds of standards when partners pay for the money that operators spend for direct costs.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Dickinson. Are there any other questions on the administrative amendments?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
On page 23. I'm not quite sure. This whole portion around D2L and D2M and on 23 lines 29. I'm looking at the bill now, page 23.
Line 29, 30, 31.
Yeah. I'm confused here. Which item are we deleting to replace N with M, or which one are we inserting here?
This whole
section is confusing to me, and I'm not. Again, it's another one of those issues, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure it's administrative. It's substantive because it's so confusing. Where it refers back and forth between sections and previous. Previous portions of the bill. This was a very confusing portion of it here.
Let's see if we can go through it. Mr. Balash.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. If we follow along on page 23, line 29, The text reads, "For the purposes of making a determination of direct cost being that list in D2," that's where you see D2N. And that is a transaction that is not at arm's length. The amount incurred to the extent that those amounts exceed fair market value, those are not direct costs. As you, and so that is all that we're talking about until you get to the first comma on line three.
Hold on a minute. So, sure. D2N is the portion that on page 21 that we've previously amended?
Correct.
And then replace D2L with D2N. And delete D2M. So what do we do with D2M?
It is deleted, sir.
It's deleted. So beginning on page 20, lines 26 through line 7 on 21.
I'm sorry, my mistake. D2M on page 23, the reference to D2M is deleted.
Oh, the reference to D2M is deleted.
Correct.
And so what, so D2M remains then?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And why was the reference deleted? Because it adds now D2N instead?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Senator Stevens, these references in subsection L, D2L and D2M, had been references in a previous version of language submitted to the drafters over at Ledge Legal, and that incorrect reference carried through in the drafting process. What had been D2M was a particular sort of transaction which has now been moved into subsection N and it is dealt with separately. So this is one of those areas where the references were rather easy to clean up between the lawyers. And so if I could continue on through the sentence here on page 23, line 30, for purposes of making a subtraction that may be required under, and it, again, it's the committee substitute text says D2L or D2M. Both of those are removed, and substituted for that is a reference to E3A. E3A is where you see adjustments to lease expenditures for specific types of transactions, sales of assets, transfers of assets, and so direct costs are when money's coming out of your pocket. The sale or transfer of assets is when essentially you're putting money back into your pocket as a producer, and so you need to adjust your lease expenditures accordingly. And that's what the reference takes care of.
That I appreciate that, Mr. Bailash, but then on the top of page 22, at the end of that E3A, it says provisions of this of sections L and N apply to the asset subject to this paragraph. So it looks like we've gone back and deleted the reference to D2L. Section L is we've gone back to the same section, and then section N is. I mean, it seems cyclical here, Mr. Chairman.
Cyclical or cyclical?
Yes, sir. It was not a cyclical.
Mr. Through the chair.
Depends on where you were raised, I guess.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, welcome to the wonderful experience I've endured talking to tax attorneys for the last 2 days. The reference on page 22, line 1 to L is referring to the subsection L. Is there a circular reference there? Yes, the provisions fit together. The reference to D2N is back in subsection D, paragraph 2, subpart N, which appears on page 21, line 7. And if you ask me to go much further, my powers of explanation are probably going to fail.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Balash, because if we go to read section N, it says that the purpose of determining adjustment by subtraction shall be made by a payment or credit that a producer has received under E3A, and then number one, sale of transferred asset is made in the amount less than would have been received at arm's length. Principles set out in L of this section, interpreted and implemented by regulation of the department authorized in L1 of this section, applies. I mean, again, it seems like we keep going back and repeating ourselves over and over again about where we go. I think that I need to have a little bit of...
Let's see if Mr. Mintz can jump in here and help us out a little.
Mr. Mintz, do you understand the confusion of the cyclical revolving L&M we're on here?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, my head is indeed spinning.
So you're on the cycle.
All of the references do make sense. It's confusing because L and M and N are repeated, but in some cases they refer to subsections of the section. In other cases they refer to subparagraphs of an earlier subsection. But I do agree, Senator Stevens, yes, there is some redundancy in the sense that one provision will say that it's governed by another provision, and then the second provision will refer back to the earlier provision, and it kind of repeats itself. He says, yes, this provision governs that earlier provision. I don't think it's a either a grammatical or a legal problem. I think it's just some repetition for purposes of making sure that there's no confusion as to what applies to what.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but I don't think this passes the KISS test.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, you know, if I look at this, I'll make it even more complicated. Because when I look at this, if I look at line 1 on page 22, those references to L and N there refer to subparagraph L on page 23 and N on page 24, not capital N and capital L, which are on the previous pages.
I understand that.
So I'm making it even. So Joe, we had you a little confused which L and N we were talking about, maybe.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I fall back to the basic question I have about this section, and actually a lot of the section and the insertion of this is what is the purpose of this cyclical repetition to go from E3A to subsection L, subsection N to the D2L and D2M. I haven't absorbed that yet, and I'd like to have some time to get that. I understand that the relationship of the sale of the asset and the sale of an arm's length transaction, and the fact that you're trying to prevent something from occurring that could possibly reduce the taxpayer's obligation. But I'm not quite sure this achieves that without confusing, and anybody that can try to figure that out that doesn't increase their taxes, I'm lost here.
Mr. Balash, he got his hand up.
Mr. Chairman, either I've gone plumb crazy or I think I can explain it a little bit for you. L sets out the process by which the department shall establish whether or not the transaction occurred at arm's length. Subsection N then establishes what sorts of transactions or what sorts of occurrences they need to then look to the process established under L to make a determination for E3A, which is a subtraction or adjustment to direct costs as lease expenditures.
So, Mr. Chairman, it appears,
Senator Seekins,
it appears as if it's not a circular non sequitur.
Next thing we know, we're going to hear about
Hittites.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Do we want to set this aside until tomorrow? And Senator Stedman?
We got him on a roll. Let's keep going. The next page, the reference is page 24, line 12 and 13. Again, I guess it's the last page of this administrative amendment number one that I'm looking at. But the bill reference is page 24, line 13, 12 and 13.
Right.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
It is four.
Got to keep this from really good order.
Anyway, the current bill ends with a paragraph that there's going to be a liability for a penalty. There's an insertion that there's going to be a 20% penalty of the underpayment. And I was wondering if I can get an explanation of that and how reasonable is 20 if it shouldn't be set at 5% or 50%.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Stedman. The penalty is 20% of the underpayment as determined by the department. They go through the return filed by the taxpayer, take a look at a transaction, go through their audit process here, and at the end of the day make a determination that you shortchange the state by $200,000. We caught you. Not only did we catch you and you have to make that payment up, but you're going to add 20% to it. The 20% comes from 26 USC 6662E, that portion of the federal tax code which sets out penalties that are a result of the Section 482 audits, and so it's a mimic of that federal code. I would note that 6662E goes on throughout to state, 6662 goes on to state that an egregious penalty is subject to a 40% penalty. An egregious underpayment is subject to a 40% penalty. We didn't want to go down that road into complexity, so I hope I answered the question.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could have one of the accountants come forward and CPAs that we have in room enlighten us. It seems to me to be a little heavy-handed and throwing out all those federal fancy statute numbers, which we don't have access to, is not very beneficial.
Let me ask a question, if I can.
Senator Seekins?
Just for the purposes of getting my mind correct prior to the discussion on the accounting side, it appears to me, and tell me if I'm right or wrong, that this is if the department requests supporting documentation and they don't produce it, or if they produce documentation that was produced after the fact to support the arm's length transaction that didn't exist at the time that they took the deduction. Am I correct there?
For the record, Robin Wilson and Director of Tax Division, through the chair, Senator Seekins, that is correct.
So it's almost tantamount to a penalty for committing fraud, or just not producing.
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, I don't really have an opinion on the comparison to fraud. It's very specific about this transfer pricing issue and really hones in on that the production taxpayer needs to have contemporaneous documentation for transfer pricing issues.
So if someone takes a shot in the dark and doesn't have their documentation, there's a bigger penalty than if they just made a mistake.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I think this would sort of address the situation where either affiliated companies or non-affiliated companies have an, what may show up is an arrangement or an agreement to sell something for non-market price.
Fraud. Well, I simplify it.
I hesitate to use that word, but yeah. That's really where it hones in on. It's not typically the result of a mistake.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all I wanted to know. All
right. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there a current provision? I mean, obviously, this is not an issue that's just brought about with the incorporation of this this piece of legislation. What are the current methodologies you have? And obviously, I would say it would probably be in regulation to prevent to be able to audit these transactions. Number one, and number two, what is the existing recourse you have if you find someone that violates the regulations? And I'm assuming it's in regulation now.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, where it may show up, just in the world of tax, usually as income tax, and with oil and gas companies, we do a worldwide combination. So where the IRS may have a transfer issue between a domestic company and a foreign affiliate, we don't have those issues per se for state income tax purposes. And so generally, we don't get into any of the transfer pricing issues, particularly with oil and gas companies, on a worldwide combination. It can come up in the arena of corporate income tax that's not oil and gas. But in general, I would say that 482 audits are very time-consuming, very expensive to do. The IRS spends a lot of time and effort on them. So I don't think our department has had any experience in the income tax area in 482 problems. And Mr. Dickinson can jump in for production tax experience.
Yeah. Senator Stevens, through the chair, Dan Dickinson speaking here. We now have a standard of actual cost, and in fact, we have gotten into issues when transfer prices were involved, particularly, say, for tankers. A production company would get billed by a shipping company. But generally, we have simply looked through those and said that's not part of what we're looking at. Actual cost is what the company is spending. And so those haven't been that hasn't been a real issue, but we believe the standard of actual cost was sufficient to look through some of these transactions. To answer the second part of your question, existing civil penalties say that if there's negligent or intentional disregard of the law, then there is a 5% amount that should be added as a penalty. And then there's additional failure to file penalties, but that's basically the negligence or intentional disregard, there is a penalty.
In regards to transfer pricing?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, no. This the existing civil penalties apply to any statement on the tax return.
Any statement on the tax return, whether it be a income, property, or production severance filing?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, this is actually part of our general statute, so it would apply to liquor taxes, cigarette taxes, anything that the department administers.
Anything?
The 5% would.
Thank you. Again, Mr. Chairman, I question, and thank you for that clarification, Mr. Dickinson. I question the fact that we have existing civil penalties for any filer that intentionally is fraudulent on any sort of transaction. And I question why we all of a sudden treat one as 20% and the others as all.
If I could just jump in, if you go to fraud, actual fraud, then there's a 50% penalty. Fraud, of course, being a much higher standard than negligence or intentional disregard.
Well, fraud's also criminal as well as civil, I believe.
Senator Stevens, to the chair, my attorney may jump in here, but it says a civil fraud penalty equal to 50% of the tax due. So it still remains a civil penalty.
Thank you, Mr. Dickinson.
Senator Seekins.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dickinson, maybe you can answer the question then. Why is it that under the amendment that the administration proposes deleting that section that allows someone to prepare the evidence of this arm's-length transaction after the fact.
Senator Seekins, through the chair, maybe you should talk to the maker of the amendment for this. I mean, what we were trying to do is make sure it fit in and work on this, but this is not a power which we generally believe is a major problem or is causing the department stress at the moment. So this is not a power that we've asked for, and it was not in the administration's original bill.
Okay.
Senator Stevens.
I'm sorry, I missed that first part of your sentence. You said this is not a situation that is currently an issue or hasn't been historically an issue then?
Well, Senator Stevens, through the chair, we have used our actual cost standard when we've been looking at downstream issues, because that's what we currently, that's the cost you get, the cost incurred between the point of production and the point of sale in, say, Los Angeles. What's now happening is we're now going to be looking at upstream costs. There may be new issues there. The folks who looked at this, the consultants hired by the legislature, thought that these additional powers would have been appropriate. Like I say, it's not something that the administration has sought. I mean, I recognize the problem, and it may exist. What we have found, at least in the areas that we've looked at so far, is we don't believe it has been a major problem.
Senator Stevens?
And the reason why you're looking at the upstream costs is because now the profit-sharing tax goes towards the entire corporate income versus the cost of producing one barrel of oil.
Senator Stevens, that's the chair, through the chair, that's correct. We're looking at upstream costs when the movement from a gross value to a net value, that's the costs of the difference, are costs of production on the North Slope.
So, my might, Mr. Chairman. So essentially now we're looking at the corporate profit of an entity that operates in the petroleum business the same way we look at the corporate profit of an entity that operates in the fish business or in the newspaper business, and the civil laws that are applicable at a 5% for intentional misfiling and a 50% for fraud are already on the books.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, this is not an income tax, and the income tax will still apply, and the industries that you discussed typically will be paying an income tax. This is a production tax, and it's different, but we certainly are getting closer to and looking at elements, and that's why we're borrowing from the IRS. It's certainly getting closer to that. So in that sense, we are looking, you know, what this amendment would suggest is that those powers that the IRS uses to look at transfer prices would be appropriate for the oil industry for this set of costs.
Thank you.
Senator Seekins.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So if I understand this correctly, what we're saying, though, here is, since this is a new area of taxing power, you're restating what your penalties may be in terms of this particular tax for avoidance of this particular tax?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, and this, again, you may want to go to the folks who suggested this, but we're importing an area of federal law that's applicable to the income tax, suggesting it's appropriate to this production tax, and then borrowing some of the penalties from that as well. I can only believe that in enforcing this portion of the tax, and I believe Ms. Wilson has told you, and I've heard this as well, I've never participated in one, that these are brutally resource-intensive audits trying to prove up these issues. And one of the issues that arises is, was documentation contemporaneous or created after the fact? So apparently they found these penalties appropriate, and so members of the United borrow.
In that regard, Mr. Chairman, we've eliminated a penalty for not having contemporaneous documentation in the amendment. It just says produce it. It doesn't have to be in existence at the time of the deduction.
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, I believe if we flip over to, it looks like page 4 of the amendment, the language that you're looking at in the CS before amendment says that the taxpayer will be liable for a penalty, and that was one of the items, right, I believe that I brought forth as a concern. I didn't know what penalty of what.
I see. Okay. I've got it. I had the wrong insertion point marked here. I was a lineup. Thank you.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, Mr. Dingus, for the follow-up. Now, you explained to me that the current system has a system for auditing transactions that occur on the downstream side. Now you referred that this incorporates, now we're going to be looking at transfer pricing or transfer cost, transfers of cost among affiliates on the upstream side. So does that mean now the downstream portions will also now see a 20% penalty, whereas before they were 5? So are we having upstream or point of production a 20% a penalty charge and downstream a 5%, or are we all 20% now?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I believe this penalty is very specific to not providing information for the specific 482 audit, which only would apply under this language to the upstream. So this 20% penalty is not a broad penalty. It wouldn't meet this, you know, it isn't mere negligence. I mean, I don't want to say mere. It has to be for that specific event. It is not replacing any other penalty or taking the standards that I read to you a moment ago that apply to 5% and applying them with a 20% standard. It's simply that this one pinpointed item. That answers your question, Rob.
Senator Stevens?
We're getting closer.
Okay.
You say it doesn't replace one. Doesn't replace the 5%, but before I thought you told me that there would be a 5% because there's a corporate statute that says if you use fraudulent information or you fail to file in under the corporate statute that it's there. But now it says that this is not there.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, and again, my attorney may jump in if I've misapprehended double jeopardy issues. I believe that if the penalties that are being sought in this amendment were applied, we would probably argue that there was also intentional disregard and ask for the 5% penalty on top of that.
On top of it?
I'm guessing. I don't know. But I'm just saying that the broad standard says if you disregard the law, if there was an intentional disregard of the law, there'll be a penalty. And I think you might argue that failing to comply with a request is a form of that, and therefore it would qualify as well. There's certainly nothing which would prohibit the application of both penalties that I want.
Now we're really getting really getting questionable as to the understanding of it, because now it's double jeopardy. You know, the point I'm trying to make, Mr. Chairman, is as Ms. Wilson stated, this area in the downstream side of the business that's been in existence now for when the first ship departed from Valdez. There may have been some hurdles and some obstacles and some litigation along the way, but now it's been in place for so long, and if I interpreted your comments correctly, you said it's not an area of concern at the current tax regime. And so now all of a sudden we say, well, everything's been going fine down there, but now we're creating something with this new system, and it's upstream, and by golly, it's not only the 5% that's been in place, but now it's a double jeopardy. You get 5% plus 20%. I'm just wondering the justification for this section. And with that, I'll be quiet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think Ms. Wilson was going to say something.
Oh, thank you. Saying something.
Senator Alden.
Well, I hesitate to get into this also, Mr. Chair, but I mean, the way I read what this component of the amendment is attempting to do is it is just saying that the department will make a determination. You have the right to ask for additional information. You can make your determination based on the additional information if they provide it, only if the additional information is contemporaneous. And if they refuse, I mean, another word for refuse is if they stiff the department and refuse to provide any information so that you can make an easy determination on an underpayment, that you can levy an additional penalty of 20% of the underpayment. So it seems to me that what we're talking about is a relatively egregious behavior on the part of the taxpayer, saying, no, I may have underpaid, but I'm not going to give you any documents that will support your position. So it gives you the, I mean, it doesn't seem to me that's an unusual kind of a penalty to levy, because you have a taxpayer that is essentially saying, well, prove it, but I'm not going to give you any of the documents that you have a right to by law. Is that a fair restatement of what this does?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, yes, I believe that's a fair
restatement.
Senator Stedman? Senator Seekins first and then Senator Stedman.
I think Senator Elton pretty much summarized what I was trying to say here. It's only that guy who refuses to substantiate their arm's-length transaction with contemporaneous data. And if they refuse, there's probably a reason why they're refusing to substantiate it. And it's a refusal of a request for information to substantiate. Is that correct? Okay.
Senator Stedman?
Yeah, I've got a, before I go into my next question, I think when we're done here, I'd like to move that this is substantive changes instead of, like, what do we have them classified as?
Administrative. They're administrative.
Right.
Substantive administrative.
Right. It's been a long day. It looks like it's going to get a little longer. On page 25 of the bill, we're looking at deleting lines 7 through 11. And I was wondering if we can get an explanation on that. It's one of those areas that didn't get marked up, so it didn't ring any alarm bells, so apparently it must have rang somebody's alarm bell.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the issue that I brought up when I raised this question was the fact that the language as it's in the CS right now, lines, as you noted, 7 through 11, do not make any sort of time limit. And so an asset could be, say, 80 years old. You took it out of the state. All of a sudden, this would require recapture of any benefit you received from that, even though it was well past its useful life. And I believe that this was taken out, but the question was cured through
page 22, line 1.
I'm looking now at page 3 of the amendment. Okay, and in about the middle of the page, it says of the amendment, it says page 22, line 1, replace N with M and insert. And so what this insertion is doing is saying simply that it's going to be limited to the value, the recapture would be limited to the value that is received. So if something is 80 years old and what's received is basically salvage value, then that's all that's really applicable.
And actually, if I can just jump in here, it, nothing's received. If you took an asset out of the state, you received a credit for it or something here, and you took it out, we're just saying look at the value and treat that as though it were a transaction. So if you're moving it from your drilling in the North Slope to drilling in Gulf of Mexico and you take it out, you received a credit for it when you brought it into the state, we're saying we want to treat that just like a recapture. Our objection was to using cost, because if you'd used it here for 10 years, it probably cost isn't appropriate. So what we're saying is you look at the value of it when you remove it from the state and treat that as though it were transaction for purposes of an Alaska production tax.
And if I may add to that just a bit, the last line of that amendment paragraphs is that the value of the asset at the time it's removed is considered a payment received.
Senator Stedman, where's the statement you're reading from?
I'm looking at page 3 of the amendment, and about the middle of that page where it says page 22, line 1.
Okay.
Yes, and then if you'll look at the last line and a half roughly.
Senator Stebbins?
Why don't you use book value of it? I mean, 80 years old is kind of a, I guess that's an outlier. You know, I assume that somebody might bring an asset that's 10 or 15 years old or 5 years old or 2 years old and then use it for 4 or 5 years and then pull it out. It's just...
Senator Stemmer, through the chair, you...
Because I'm just not following the...
This met our objection. You'd have to ask the maker of the amendment question. I mean, that would be another way of looking at value.
Okay, I think maybe what we should do is have alleged legal give us, because this is getting kind of complicated, give us an opinion or an opinion on this, in the impact of these amendments. We'll keep him busy.
Chair.
Senator Stevens.
You can explain the impact of them.
Just for a second, Bert, what did you mean by book value? Depreciated value on the books?
Right.
Because it could be depreciated to zero.
Right.
There would be no recapture then. So
right.
Is that what you're looking at?
Right. I just don't quite. And again, you know, I haven't had a chance to read through this, and we're trying to piece this bill together. So we're trying to. But we can certainly get an opinion from the drafter. I don't.
Senator Stevens, sure, if I might just respond, and I think Senator Stevens has addressed. I mean, there's tax. You know, there's could be the tax value. Accelerated depreciation, it could be book. I mean, there are various, if you go to book, you'd probably have to go, say, financial accounting, yada, 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 yada. I think what satisfied us is that value here recognized the fact that if such a thing occurs, the department will, you know, the taxpayer may disagree, but at least you're all trying to get to the same thing, the value of the asset when it is removed. And so you could be more specific.
Senator Seeger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is regardless of whether or not the asset is sold. If there has to be a valuation of it, if it's transferred from production of their fields in Alaska versus production of their fields off the coast of California, somewhere someone has to assign a value to it when it's removed, if I understand. Who would do that?
Senator Seeger, through the chair. Yeah, in fact, if it were sold, then we think it would show up. This is when it isn't sold. Taxpayer would sell file, we'd audit, we'd look at it, we'd either say that's acceptable or it's not. But in the first instance, the taxpayer would be assigning the value.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seekins.
So at the point that it was resold, we would recapture the value on the PPT. Also, we would recapture it under income tax?
Senator Seekins, through the chair, I mean, that is correct. The mechanism would be slightly different. One would go into worldwide income.
Right.
But that is correct. Both transactions would show up.
But
removal from the state would not trigger an income tax obligation.
Right.
It would be a PPT obligation.
But this would on a PPT. That's what I wanted to know.
So it's treated differently. Further questions? I just question what Ledge Legal is going to give us that our tax accountants that we had look at this and the administration hasn't. Seems to be like our advisors, our tax consultants have sat down with the administration and worked through this, and I don't know where Ledge Legal would go with it. I mean,
go ahead.
Senator Mr. David. Chairman, I think the question that I would pose to Ledge Legal is what's the purpose of this? And explain to me why there's this needed layer on top of an existing a legal structure in civil as well as, it seems to me, criminal statutes that have to do with transfer pricing, transfer cost transfers, as well as fraud, and as well as the withholding of documents that I would assume exists across the corporate tax world. So those would be the questions I'm asking. I still have not been convinced that there's a need for this that's not an additive punitive reasoning only on upstream operations. Because as Mr. Dickinson told us, it only targets one area of the cost transfers, not downstream, not in anywhere else. So that's the question I would ask. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Senator Stevens?
I don't think that that's going to slow down our process.
No, we can hold this and get the information.
No, we'll just keep on going. I just, you know, I mean, this stuff is getting rather technical and rather complex, and there's a lot of people working on it with different opinions, and I think as we put these insertions into the bill and work through it, a lot of this stuff's going to start coming together.
Senator Elder?
And kind of a friendly suggestion, maybe to Senator Stedman and Stevens. I mean, I understand what they're trying to do, but maybe we shouldn't put all the burden on Ledge Legal. I mean, those provisions that have been sought by and suggested by the administration, maybe they can give the rationale rather than Ledge Legal, because I have a feeling that Ledge Legal would have to get in touch with the administration. So perhaps the penalty component could be looked at by Ledge Legal. The cost of transferring assets out of, or the reason for transferring assets out of the street, out of the state, could be done by the administration.
Senator Seekins.
Well, I can, however we want to approach that, but I just have to ask a question before we get to that point, and that is, I think it's definitely an improvement to put a number in there rather than just to say subject to a penalty. So maybe I should ask, if we're looking at whether or not the idea is that there be no penalty, or whether we're concerned about the dollar amount or the percentage that's put in there as a penalty. Maybe that would help me understand where we're trying to go.
Further questions? Okay. With that, I want to set this aside, and we'll contact Ledge Legal in the morning first thing.
Are we looking kind of like a sectional analysis?
And
Mr. Chairman, if I may, that Ledge Legal's involvement has been minimal. What we will do is get a better explanation for you from administration on the insertions that they have, and from the tax attorneys that were involved in it.
Well, and get a hold of Ledge Legal.
They won't be able to write a sectional and do your drafting at the same time. Mr. Chairman, the only other thing that I wanted to add to it was that I called it administrative, not because it wasn't substantive, and I want to be very clear on that. I called it administrative because these were predominantly issues that were raised by the administration. I could have called them administration or whatever. It was just an easy way for me to identify that these were ones that were very specific to the administration. They had some very concerns with the issues on those roadmaps there. So,
and we didn't get as far as I wanted to go today, but we're going to recess until call the chair tomorrow, and that'll be at 10 o'clock. In this,
we canceled the judiciary, so if you wanted to start any earlier, you could.
I think 10 is fine because we got to get some information before we go. So 10 o'clock back here. That will just recess until 10 in the morning.
Because I canceled judiciary.